Before we get into talking about Nebuchadnezzar's dream, I would like to give you just a little refresher on what the covenant is that God made with King David. So let's take our Bibles and turn to 1 Chronicles chapter 17. Chronicles chapter 17, verse 1. Now it came to pass when David was dwelling in his house, that David said to Nathan the prophet, "See now, I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of the covenant of the Lord is under a tent of curtains." Then Nathan said to David, "Do what is in your heart, for God is with you." But it happened that night that the word of God came to Nathan, saying, "Go tell my servant David, thus says the Lord, you shall not build me a house to dwell in. For I have not dwelt in a house since the time that I brought up Israel, even to this day, but have gone from tent to tent, from one tabernacle to another. Wherever I have moved about with all Israel, have I ever spoken a word to any of the judges of Israel, whom I commanded to shepherd my people, saying, why have you not built me a house of cedar? Now therefore, thus you shall say to my servant David, thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the sheepfold, from following the sheep, to be a ruler over my people Israel. And I have been with you wherever you have gone, and have cut off all your enemies from before you. And I have made you a name like the name of the great men who are in the earth. Moreover, I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them, that they may dwell in a place of their own, and no more move, nor shall the sons of wickedness oppress them any more, as previously. Since the time that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, also I will subdue all your enemies. Furthermore, I tell you that the Lord will build you a house. And it shall be, when your days are fulfilled, when you must go to be with your fathers, that I will set up your seed after you, who will be of your sons, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build me a house, and I will establish his throne forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. And I will not take my mercy away from him as I took it from him who was before you. And I will establish him in my house and in my kingdom forever, and his throne shall be established forever. According to all these words and according to all this vision, so Nathan spoke to David." Now, this is a very remarkable promise that God gave to David, and for all intents and purposes, when you read the story and you read the history of what happened, it sounds exactly like a prophecy of King Solomon, right? Solomon's, or David's son. Because God did not allow David to build the temple for him, a permanent structure, but he did allow his son Solomon to build him a temple. For all intents and purposes, it sounds like he's talking about Solomon. So the question I have for you now is, was he talking about Solomon? Who said no? What do you think?
Solomon's dead.
So did he establish Solomon's throne forever?
No.
Did God lie?
No.
Then how do we explain this?
It's conditional.
It was conditional. Was it conditional whether or not God was going to fulfill the covenant that he made with David?
No.
Was it conditional about through whom he would use to fulfill his covenant with David? Yes. See, what we see here is God allowing Solomon the opportunity to fulfill the covenant that he made with his father David. And Solomon began to do that. He built the house of God, right? And so forth. But ultimately, we know that Solomon failed, didn't he? Let's go to Psalms chapter 89. Verse 20. Actually, Verse 20, Psalm 89, verse 20. I have found my servant David. With my holy oil I have anointed him. With whom my hand shall be established. Also my arm shall strengthen him. The enemy shall not outwit him, nor the son of wickedness afflict him. I will beat down his foes before his face and plague those who hate him. But my faithfulness and my mercy shall be with him, and in my name his horn shall be exalted. I also will set his hand over the sea and his right hand over the rivers. He shall cry to me, you are my Father, my God, and the rock of my salvation. Also I will make him my firstborn, the highest of the kings of the earth. My mercy I will keep for him forever. My covenant shall stand firm with him. His seed also I will make to endure forever, and his throne as the days of heaven. If his sons forsake my law and do not walk in my judgments, if they break my statutes and do not keep my commandments, then I will punish their transgression with the rod and their iniquity with stripes. Nevertheless, my loving kindness I will not utterly take away from him, nor allow my faithfulness to fail. My covenant I will not break, nor alter the word that has gone out of my lips. Once I have sworn to my by my holiness, I will not lie to David. His seed shall endure forever, and his throne as the sun before me. It shall be established forever like the moon, even like the faithful witness in the sky. God is essentially saying, as long as you can look up in the sky and see that the moon is still there, then his covenant with David has not failed and will not fail. As long as the moon endures. God is the one who keeps his covenant and mercy to 1,000 generations, the scripture says. Right? Over and over and over again, we see that happen. Now I want you to go to 2 Chronicles chapter 7. Verse 11. 2 Chronicles chapter 7 and verse 11. Thus Solomon finished the house of the Lord and the king's house. And Solomon successfully accomplished all that came into his heart to make in the house of the Lord and in his own house. Then the Lord appeared to Solomon by night and said to him, I have heard your prayer and have chosen this place for myself as a house of sacrifice. When I shut up heaven and there is no rain, or command the locusts to devour the land, or send pestilence among my people, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and heal their land. Now my eyes will be open and my ears attentive to prayers made in this place. For now I have chosen and sanctified this house that my name may be there forever. And my eyes and my heart will be there perpetually. As for you, Solomon, if you walk before me as your father David walked, and do according to all that I have commanded you, and if you keep my statutes and my judgments, then I will establish the throne of your kingdom as I covenanted with David your father, saying, you shall not fail to have a man ruler in Israel. But if you turn away and forsake my statutes and my commandments, which I have set before you, and go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will uproot them from my land that I have given them, and this house, which I have sanctified for my name, I will cast out of my sight. And I will make it a proverb and a byword among all peoples. And as for this house, which is exalted, everyone who passes by it will be astonished and say, why has the Lord done this to this land and this house? And they will answer, because they forsook the Lord God of their fathers, who brought them out of the land of Egypt, and embraced other gods and worshiped them and served them. Therefore he has brought all this calamity upon them. God told Solomon specifically that he could be the son of David to fulfill the covenant that God made with David. But he put a nice big fat if in that statement in verse 17. And so what did Solomon do? You know, God told Solomon, for one thing, he told the kings of Israel not to accumulate, you know, horses and chariots and all the military equipment. He told him not to do that. He told him not to marry foreign wives. And just about everything God specifically said to the kings of Israel not to do, Solomon did. And he didn't just do it a little bit. He went way overboard, right? Marrying many, many, many foreign women and so forth. And the Bible goes on to say that these women did exactly what God said would happen if they married foreign women who worshiped idols. And what was that? They would turn away his heart from worshiping the Lord. And that's exactly what happened. And so Solomon built many pagan temples and idols and so forth for all his many wives so they could go on worshiping their pagan gods and goddesses that they had brought into Israel from these foreign lands. And so God rejected Solomon from being king over Israel. But you know, God also told David he was going to build him a house or a dynasty, right? And so what we see, if we follow the narrative through the scriptures, is that when Solomon died, one of Solomon's sons became king. And then when he died, another son became king, right? And we have generation after generation after generation of the kings of Judah ruling over God's people Israel. And if you go through the story, it's a sad story, because as it recounts these kings, generation after generation, it says that they did not walk in the ways of God, right? Occasionally, we have one king who did what was right in the sight of the Lord, and he would bless him in that particular kingdom. But the vast majority did not follow God. And we see that even right after Solomon's reign, there was a power struggle over who was going to succeed him. And the kingdom of Israel was split in two, because part followed one king, part followed the other king. We see the majority, the northern 10 tribes, separated from the southern two tribes in Jerusalem, and the line of David was really narrowed down only to two tribes that it was really governing over throughout. God finally sent the Assyrians in and took the northern tribes captive because they were pagan. These tribes did not worship God from the get-go. And then the southern tribes, there was some good there, some bad. It was a mix, right? Ultimately, God had had enough with the southern kingdom. And we have this whole series of kings. All of them were descendants of David through Solomon, all the way down until we get to Jehoiakim, which we talked about this morning. Jehoiakim is the guy who Nebuchadnezzar came to Jerusalem while he was king, forced him into submission, and then actually he took him out of commission. He died actually while he was in bondage, and Nebuchadnezzar put his son Jehoiachin, who was also a descendant of David, also named Coniah. Remember that? Jeconiah. Those are all terms for the same man. 3 months later, Nebuchadnezzar changed his mind, came back, captured him, and installed the final king of Judah, Zedekiah. And then we pick up the story of the destruction of Jerusalem, which we're going to talk about Nebuchadnezzar's image here in just a moment. Now, how does God fulfill these covenants when those who appear to be the ones to receive the promises of God have failed so badly? How does he ultimately fulfill his promises? Because, you know, God made a covenant with Abraham, right? You would think, you know, God said he was going to make a great nation, and all these promises that he promised to the nation of Israel, and he gave them the opportunity when he brought them into the land, right? He gave them the opportunity, but they failed. Ultimately, we see in the New Testament that the fulfillment of the promises to Abraham is going to be through Jesus Christ, that ultimate son or seed of Abraham, who God, because humanity has failed, God sends his son to complete the promises, to be faithful, and ultimately to bring those promises to fruition to us, to mankind, through his own son. He does this with the Abrahamic covenant by fulfilling it through his son, and he's going to do it as well with the Davidic covenant, the covenant he made with David, which is why when you start reading in your Bible in the New Testament, the very first verses of the New Testament, in Matthew chapter 1, it starts off by saying, the generations of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. The reason it mentions those two men, and then it immediately gives the genealogy of Jesus, tracing it back through King David, and then all the way back through Abraham, is because what it's telling you is that Jesus Christ is the one through whom God is going to fulfill these promises, because Solomon failed, because the 12 tribes of Israel failed when they were given these opportunities. God is ultimately going to keep his promises no matter what, even if he's got to send his own son to do it. He has orchestrated all of history with these ideas in mind, that he first gives humanity the opportunity to make the right choices, and when they fail, he brings in his son to do it for us. You know, it's really a remarkable thing that God has done. What I want you to know is that Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and you see the statue there, you're all familiar with the dream of Nebuchadnezzar and how it represents a sequence of kingdoms. But what I want you to have clear in your mind as we look at Nebuchadnezzar's dream is that the reason for this image and this sequence of kingdoms and this revelation that God has given us of how these things are going to unfold all the way down until the coming of the Messiah and his kingdom is established upon the earth. The reason that's there is it is filling the vacuum left when the last king of Israel, who was reigning on the throne of David, which was Zedekiah, when Nebuchadnezzar brought his kingdom to an end, there is no Davidic king until God fulfills it with his son, Jesus Christ. All right? This image represents the pagan nations that are going to rule over God's people because of their failures. They could have their Messiah, but instead of having their Messiah of the seed of David to fulfill the promises, instead they have pagan kingdoms that are going to reign over them and oppress them for all these generations, until finally God is going to smash that idol. And the reason it's an idol or an image is because it represents pagan governments, pagan kings, which they worship idols, right? And so that's what this thing represents. In Isaiah 9:67, we have the promise of the coming Messiah. And what does Isaiah say? Unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. The government will be upon his shoulder, right? Talks about his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, actually Father of the coming age, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end upon the throne of David. He's going to sit upon the throne of David and fulfill the covenant that God made with David. But in the meantime, because of Israel's rebellion, and particularly because of Solomon's rebellion, when God told Solomon, if you will obey, I will make you that man. And Solomon failed. And then Solomon's son failed, and his son failed, and his son failed, and his son failed. 10 kings in a row failed. And so finally God says, I'm going to stop this. And you know, what we're going to see is that the way God did this, he prophesied through the prophet Jeremiah that the rightful heir, who was Jehoiachin, the one who Nebuchadnezzar took captive to Babylon, also called Coniah or Jeconiah. The prophet, our prophet Jeremiah, through Jeremiah, God says to that man, to Jehoiachin, he says, he shall not have an heir to sit upon the throne. That no seed from his body is ever going to sit upon the throne of David. And so it appears from Jeremiah's prophecy that the Davidic covenant has failed. Because God says he's going to do it through this seed, but ultimately he puts an end to it when Nebuchadnezzar comes down and takes away the last king of Israel. So how is God going to fulfill his covenant with David? Well, God had this fantastic plan. He said it would come from David's own seed, from his own body. So what does he do? Look at the genealogies in Matthew and in Luke. Jesus Christ is born through Mary, whose ancestry is traced back through Nathan's other son. I'm sorry, through David's other son, Nathan. And not only that, she ends up marrying a guy named Joseph, who is a descendant of the rightful king from Solomon. The only thing is, Jesus was not the physical offspring of him. So when his offspring was cursed, the curse does not apply to Christ, because Christ was adopted by him. He had God as his father. Mary was a virgin. God constructed all this stuff so that the curse that he put upon the seed of David would not flow to his son, Jesus Christ. He had all this planned in advance. He accounted for man's failure. He accounted for Solomon's failure. He knew all that was going to happen. And he worked it all out so that ultimately in the end he will fulfill to the letter his promises to David in ways that are absolutely miraculous. And I think it's absolutely stunning and remarkable how God foresaw all this and made accommodations for mankind's failures and wickedness. All right, well, let's go to Daniel chapter 2, and let's look at Nebuchadnezzar's dream. A lot of people are confused about the chronology in Daniel, so let me just make a couple of comments about that. It tells us in the first verse in Daniel 1 that in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried away to the land of Shinar and the house of his God. And he brought articles into the treasure house of his God, and so forth. And then it goes on to give Daniel's story, because Daniel was one of the captives or hostages that he took back with him. Now, this is when Jehoiakim died. He died actually during the siege. And his son, Jehoiachin, was placed by Israel in charge. But then Nebuchadnezzar defeated him, took him captive, installed Zedekiah. And then we have 11 more years, and then the destruction of Jerusalem. Right? Now, when you get to chapter 2, it says, in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar, that he had this dream. And a lot of people think, well, that means the second year that Nebuchadnezzar was king. And that's not the case. Daniel's not dating things from when a foreign king came to power in his own country, right? Everything Daniel does, and the prophets of Israel as well, all the prophets, they date things based on when some king, you know, gained jurisdiction over them, okay? When he reigned supreme over them as a people. And this is what we'll see Ezekiel do. In fact, in Ezekiel's prophecy, he counts from the year of our captivity. He was one of the ones taken hostage, so he counts from all his prophecies from the year of when Nebuchadnezzar first came and took him and Daniel and the other captives. Daniel, on the other hand, counts from after Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem and had all the Jews under his subjection that were left. He does that. Now, we know that his vision did not occur in his second year of his reign, because Daniel was one of the ones that was taken captive, and Daniel was under a three-year training program, it says in chapter 1, and he completed his training program before this happened. So the vision and him interpreting it, all that, which was after his training program, could not have been during that three-year period. So it's not the second year that Nebuchadnezzar reigned. All right, it's the second year following the destruction of Jerusalem. That is, it's the year after Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem and assumed control of all these kingdoms around Judea as well. Now, let's read chapter 2, and then we're going to try to talk about these different components of the image and what they represent. All right. Now, in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar, reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was troubled, that his sleep left him. Then the king gave the command to call magicians and astrologers and sorcerers and the Chaldeans to tell the king's dreams. So they came and stood before the king. And the king said to them, I have had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to know the dream. Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will give the interpretation. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, My decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me and its interpretation, You shall be cut in pieces, and your house shall be made an ash heap. However, if you tell the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts, rewards, and great honor. Therefore, tell me the dream and its interpretation. They answered again and said, let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will give its interpretation. The king answered and said, I know for certain that you would gain time, because you see that my decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me, there is only one decree for you. For you have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the time has changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you give me its interpretation. I think this is a pretty wise statement. Because these guys are supposed to be, you know, have some kind of insight into, you know, or connection with the gods, and are supposed to be able to interpret dreams. Well, if they can really interpret the dream, then they should be able to tell him the dream, right? I think it's a pretty smart thing he did here. He's weeding out the ones who are going to give him a song and a dance, right? All right, it's cool. Anyway, so verse 10, the Chaldeans answered the king and said, there's not a man on earth who can tell the king's matter. Therefore, no king, lord, or ruler has ever asked such things of any magician, astrologer, or Chaldean. It is a difficult thing that the king requests, and there is no other who can tell it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. For this reason, the king was angry and very furious. He gave the command to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree went out, and they began killing the wise men. And they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Now, you may notice here that Daniel and his companions are not in the training program anymore, are they? They are considered among the ones who are supposed to be able to tell these things to the king. All right? All right, so he goes on. Then with counsel and wisdom, Daniel asked Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is a decree from the king so urgent? Then Arioch made the decision known to Daniel. So Daniel went in and asked the king to give him time, that he might tell the king the interpretation. Then Daniel went to his house and made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they might seek mercies from the God of heaven concerning the secret, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. So Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. And he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's demand. Therefore Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said to him, do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me before the king, and I will tell the king the interpretation. Then Arioch quickly brought Daniel before the king and said thus to him, I have found a man of the captives of Judah who will make known to the king the interpretation. The king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar. By the way, that name is the Babylonian name that was given to Daniel when he became one of the wise men Babylon, and it has the Babylon god, Bel, as the prefix to the name. Are you able to make known to me the dream which we have seen and its interpretation? Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers cannot declare to the king, but there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these. As for you, O king, thoughts came to your mind while on your bed about what would come to pass after this. And he who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be. But as for me, this secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone living, but for our sakes, who make known the interpretation to the king, and that you may know the thoughts of your heart. Notice that the interpretation was for the sake of the Hebrew captives. Verse 31. You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. The image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold were crushed together and became like the chaff from the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is the dream. Now we will tell its interpretation before the king. You, O king, are a king of kings. For the God of heaven has given you power, a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field, and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. You are the head of gold. But after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours, then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything, and like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. And by the way, all the others is not a good translation. It literally says everything, not specifically referring to the other kingdom's name. Whereas you saw the feet and toes partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, yet the strength of iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly iron and partly clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain and its interpretation is sure. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel, and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. And the king answered Daniel and said, "Truly your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and the revealer of secrets, since you couldn't reveal this secret." Now, let's look at these different kingdoms that Nebuchadnezzar's image represents. Daniel says that the head of gold is Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. His kingdom was the kingdom of the Babylonians. What kingdom followed Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom? I don't hear anybody. The Persians, right? And who was the sort of the head of the Persian kingdom? Cyrus the Great, right? And which kingdom followed after Cyrus? Who defeated the Persians? Greeks, Alexander the Great. And what happened to Alexander's kingdom? Who can tell me? What happened to Alexander? Does anybody know? After he defeated the Persians? I think Hannah was going to answer. Ben. All right, what happened to Alexander, though? He got killed? He just died suddenly. He got sick and died. He was, you know, anybody know how old he was? 33 years old when he died. In fact, he was mourning because he had conquered so much of the world. It's like, you know, what else is there to do? Right? In fact, his army was actually about to revolt because he was conquering so much of the known world. He was actually on his way to press into India to continue going east. And his army began to revolt against him, saying, "You know what? We've had enough. We want to go home." Anyway, Alexander got ill. He died. He did not have an heir. And so his kingdom was divided up amongst his four generals. Does anybody know the four divisions of Alexander's kingdom? generally geographically. You don't have to name the actual
north,
general.
South, east, and west.
Well, yeah, actually, you're pretty close. Yeah. Well, it was divided amongst his four generals. There were two divisions that we would call sort of minor, because they ended up being fairly weak kingdoms, and they didn't really retain a lot of their territory. There was one that was Macedonia, the area around Greece, and then Turkey, what we call Turkey today. But the larger two were what was called the Seleucid Empire, which really comprised of Syria and, you know, Palestine and pretty much everything east, Iran, Iraq. That whole huge area became part of the Seleucid Empire, which was one of those divisions, and then the Egyptian was the other. And what we see happening after his death was these kingdoms fighting, you know, just kind of bickering amongst themselves and fighting for territory, and there was wars back and forth between them, and there was a lot of confusion and war that went on until finally Rome, the Roman Empire, began to rise in the West. And it literally started swallowing these things up until it eventually basically took almost all of it over, except the far east, eastern portions of that kingdom. But the bronze on the image here, the belly and thighs of bronze, were a representation of Alexander's kingdom after he defeated the Persians, and then his kingdom being divided, and then we see finally these legs of iron. Now the Bible, the book of Daniel, actually identifies these kingdoms by name. All right, now they're not all identified in this particular passage, because the only one actually identified is Babylon, you know, Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, right, the head of gold. But as we begin to work our way through Daniel, these things begin to, he begins to fill in details, and he begins to name these kingdoms. He talks about the Persians coming afterwards. He talks then about the Greeks, Alexander, and naming these kingdoms by name. He talks about the division of Alexander's kingdom, and then he talks about this fourth terrible beast, which is also the legs of iron here, all right? And we're going to be spending a lot of time in chapters 7 and 8, because they develop this picture for us in much greater focus. But a few things I want to notice now about this particular image of gold and silver and bronze and iron, and then finally we have the feet. The legs of iron is the Roman Empire. I think most of you know that, but we'll see how that has to be true a little bit later as we get into chapters 7 and 8. What I want you to notice, though, is the feet of iron mixed with clay. What's clear about this passage is that the final kingdom, of which there are going to be 10 kings that reign simultaneously, which are the toes. How do we know that the toes are kings in this particular passage? We find out definitely in chapter 7, but how do we know from this passage that the 10 toes are 10 kings that reign together? How do we know that? Can anybody look at the passage and tell me that?
The days of these kings.
Go ahead, read that. Verse 44.
And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed.
Right. Now, when he says the days of these kings is when the God of heaven is going to set up a kingdom, they have to be kings that are reigning contemporary with each other. He can't be talking about Nebuchadnezzar and then Cyrus and then Alexander and then the Caesars and all that, because they are many generations apart. So he couldn't set up a kingdom in the days of those kings. The days of these kings refers to the 10 toes. All right? And as we'll see in chapter 7, it specifically names 10 kings. All right? 10 kings that are going to reign simultaneously. I want you to notice that the Antichrist is not mentioned in this prophecy. Did you notice that? Now we know, according to Revelation chapter 17, I don't want to get into Revelation tonight, but in Revelation chapter 17, it talks about 10 kings reigning simultaneously who are going to turn over their kingdom and their dominion to the Antichrist. That is, they are going to voluntarily give him the authority to rule over their kingdoms. All right, but what I want you to notice from this passage tonight is that these 10 kings come out of the previous empire. All right? They come out of it. In fact, when we get to chapter 7, it specifically says that they do. They come out of the fourth empire. All right? So they come back. It's not a totally different kingdom. The feet and the toes are not a totally different kingdom. They are in a way related to the previous kingdom and come out of that kingdom, but they are not identical with the previous kingdom. All right, so if we say that the legs of iron are the Roman Empire, the feet and toes are not the Roman Empire, but they are related to the Roman Empire and they come out of the Roman Empire. All right, so we're going to talk a lot more about that when we get to chapter 7. Let's see. Okay, I want to just briefly talk about this image. You know, when we get to chapter 3, right after Nebuchadnezzar has this dream of this great image, what does that do for his ego? You, Nebuchadnezzar, are the head of gold. What does that do for his ego? He gets really, really big ego, right? He really gets inflated. I mean, he's just destroyed Jerusalem, and he's got, you know, all these captives now. And so now what does he do? He's impressed with Daniel's God, right? I mean, Daniel's God told him his dream and told him the interpretation of his dream. He's really impressed with Daniel's God, but he's not impressed nearly enough. Isn't that right? He's not impressed enough. God's going to humble this man, right? He's going to show him who is ruling, truly ruling over the affairs of humanity. Who's the one who has actually put Nebuchadnezzar in power? And he brought Nebuchadnezzar into the world and he can take him out, right? And he did, as we'll see later. All right, so what does he do? He builds this great image in chapter 3. And Nebuchadnezzar orders that when the music plays, all these people from all these nations that he's conquered, they have to bow down and worship his image, which of course, it's a huge image, but it's not a head of gold, chest of silver, belly of bronze, legs of iron, and feet of iron and clay. No, the whole image is gold. Right? What's he saying? Right? I'm the top dog, is what he's saying. Who's greater than me? The guy had a huge ego. Anyway, he commanded them to bow down and worship his image. And of course, you know the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego who refused to bow. And then, what does God do? He delivers them from the furnace. Those people who are absolutely determined to follow God, to follow his commandments, even if it means their life. You know their prayer. What was their prayer? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I mean, what did they say to Nebuchadnezzar when he said, you must bow down or I'm going to throw you in the fiery furnace? What did they say? Our God is able to deliver us from your hand. But if not, if he doesn't do it, we still will not bow down and worship your image. That's what they said. They got thrown in the furnace and God delivered them. Listen, that is a message for us. That's a message for us. You see, this scenario, I told you this morning that God works in repeated patterns because there is an Antichrist coming. And he is going to set up an image. It's in Revelation chapter 13. And he is going to require that all people must worship the image of the beast. And anyone who does not worship the image of the beast will not be allowed to buy or sell, which means you're going to starve, right? Unless God provides some other way. Most of Christianity has been conditioned so that they'll think, you know what? God's grace is big enough that I can go ahead and take the mark, I can bow down, and God will deliver me. Right? No, it ain't going to happen. He says, specifically in Revelation, if anyone does that, then God is going to burn him to a crisp. I mean, that's my paraphrase. But that's what it says. Yes. Alright? Listen, we have to have the mentality of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. When that image is set up with that Antichrist, with that enormous ego, who thinks that he is greater than God, that we are going to worship the one true God, and we're going to tell him to put it where the sun don't shine. Right? That's right. We are not going to bow down to your image. We're going to be obedient to our God. We will worship him and him alone. All right? So that's our lesson for tonight. Any comments or questions about this? About this actual sermon? Yes, Jennifer.
You said the Ten Kingdoms, are those the ones that are still to come?
They are to come, yes.
So which ones are those?
Well, we are going to talk about that in future lessons. Okay? It's very important, actually, for us. You know, all of us are looking at the world situation, which is very fluid right now, right? I mean, it seems to have, all of a sudden, things are changing almost as fast as you can keep up with them. And what we are seeing is the beginnings of a shaking up that is going to rearrange the world kingdoms as we know them. And what's going to emerge from that is these 10 kings, these 10 kingdoms, all right? And these are the ones who are going to reign along with the Antichrist when he comes. He's going to come after they arise, all right? But he's coming. He's not mentioned in this particular passage, but we'll see in chapter 7 that he is. And he comes on the scene after these 10 are reigning simultaneously together. All right, so the next thing that we're looking for in the world scene is recognizing these 10 kingdoms that are going to arise, these 10 kings, okay, because they're coming very soon. In what way? Yeah. Event. Yes. Yes. But he's not going to gain those kingdoms in the way Nebuchadnezzar did. He did by force. All right. The Antichrist is. These other kings are going to voluntarily turn their kingdoms over to him, which we'll see. But I don't want to get too far ahead because the Antichrist is not mentioned in this. In this prophecy, only the 10 final kings. All right. So what we have, just a second. What we have here, this prophecy is sort of the big overview of from the time that God brought an end to the kings that were sitting on the throne of David. When he brought that to an abrupt end through Nebuchadnezzar, the very next year Nebuchadnezzar gets this dream. And God reveals to Daniel and to God's people how they are going to be ruled over by pagans all the way until that stone strikes the image on the feet and the Messiah, the true son of David, the one who's going to fulfill the covenant that God made with David until he steps on the scene and becomes King of Kings and Lord of Lords and crushes all these world kingdoms. All right, that's at the second coming of Christ. All right, this is the pagan time period when Israel has no king, except pagans ruling over them. All right, any other questions? Yeah, Stephen.
So, fulfilled prophecy is perhaps the most compelling argument for the reading of the Bible.
Absolutely, yeah.
So what would you say to somebody who said, you know, all this book of Daniel was written after all these kingdoms came to power and didn't really predict them, it was a review on what it all happened?
Well, the book of Daniel, Daniel claims to have been written during these events, okay? And the copies of Daniel among the Dead Sea Scrolls actually support that. Now, those copies don't go quite back that far because, you know, I mean, they're copies of copies of copies of copies. But they go back sufficiently far enough to at least a couple of hundred years before Christ, or at least 150 years before Christ, actual copies that are that old of Daniel that do contain, for example, the 70-week prophecy. Now, the 70-week prophecy tells us exactly when Christ was going to be crucified, counting from Cyrus's decree, right? Now, that was, I mean, Christ was crucified at least 200 years after those copies of Daniel, right? So we have that. Daniel also prophesied the second destruction of Jerusalem following the crucifixion. That happened 40 years after Christ's crucifixion. So there's enough of it that was still future from Daniel's, or even from the earliest copies that we have of Daniel, to provide the proof, in my opinion, to substantiate that the book itself is indeed that old and therefore is reliable. All right? There's nothing has been uncovered that really provides any credence to the idea that the book of Daniel was not actually written by Daniel. All right, at least parts of it were written by Daniel. The visions were written by Daniel. Perhaps someone collected his writings together and put them in one book. Okay, that's a possibility. But the prophecies themselves are indeed as old as Daniel. Right? And there's really no reason not to believe that. The reason some people say that is because the prophecies are so precise, especially when you get to chapter 11, where, I mean, it names king after king after king, what's going to happen in succession, all down through Alexander's kingdom after it was divided. And the Seleucid Empire, that one of those divisions, took power. And he names the kings one after the other in that empire, what they're going to do, down to Antiochus Epiphanes and his, you know, desecrating the temple being cleansed, what the Maccabees are going to do. He gives so much detail. And really, what's so amazing about Daniel, it's so accurate and so precise that the skeptics say it can't possibly have been written beforehand. Because nobody can tell the future. Well, duh. That's the argument that is divine, because God alone can tell the future, right? The 70-week prophecy is the fly in the ointment for that argument, because it predicts things that are long after the copies we actually have of Daniel that they couldn't possibly have known. And the fact that it predicts the date of Christ's crucifixion, the actual date, I mean right down to the year of Christ's crucifixion, and it happened on that year, there is no way that that could not be divine. All right, it just can't happen. No human being can do that. So, all right, anybody else? Yes? You mean as far as being like the head of gold and so forth? I think it's because God used Nebuchadnezzar as a tool. He did Cyrus as well, but he used Nebuchadnezzar as a tool of his judgment on his own people, because his own people had sinned against me. In fact, there's one passage where God says that he was, prior to the destruction, he said he was going to put hooks in Nebuchadnezzar's jaw and drag him down to Jerusalem to destroy it. All right, he was showing so much how God had this all under control. He was using Nebuchadnezzar as his battering ram, if you will, to break down Jerusalem and the temple, to judge his people. He prophesied all of this by Jeremiah, who prophesied for 40 years up until the very year that Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem, and then Jeremiah stopped prophesying. There was nothing else to say. Jeremiah, God sent him to warn his people over and over and over and over, and when finally he brought his judgment with Nebuchadnezzar, there's nothing left to warn. Right? Nothing left. So, anyway. Anything else? Questions? Comments? What's that? Hannah. I'm sorry, Hannah, did you have a question? I forgot. Are they related to this passage? Okay, go ahead. Well, let's start with one, and we'll see how far I get. I can't hear you very well. You have to shout it out. I got this air conditioner yelling at me back here.
Do you think it would have made a difference if there hadn't been the Mosaic
covenant when God promised Solomon that he reigned forever, he didn't do anything wrong? Abraham's covenant seemed pretty strict. I'm not really sure what you're asking. You're asking me a hypothetical question, right? What if kind of a question? I don't know. All I know is that what he told Solomon was that he would fulfill the covenant he made with David through him. He didn't really say, you know, anything about the Mosaic covenant, but he said the covenant he made with David, that he would fulfill it through him if he would keep all of his commands. But you're right in a sense, because a lot of his commands were what was included in the Law of Moses. So the Law of Moses actually gave commands for Israel's kings whenever they did have, whenever they would have kings in the future. You know, he actually gave commands for their kings on what they could or could not do, and God repeated that when he appeared to Solomon, so I don't know if that helps, but a little bit.
I think I'll explain it again after.
All right. All right, we'll have a conversation about it. All right. Anybody else want to throw anything in there? No? Okay, yeah.
This is just something simple, but you know, after Nebuchadnezzar had issued the decree to kill all the wise men, when the captain of the guard came in, he said, "I have found a wise man among the captain's people." And in an earlier chapter, I think at the end of chapter 1, it talks about how the king had interviewed Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and their wisdom given to them by God was quite evident. Said, "You're better than all the wise men that I currently have." So on one hand, the scripture basically says that Nebuchadnezzar knew who they were, yet the captain of the guard busts in and says, "Wait, I found someone among the people of Israel," almost as if the king didn't know who they were.
The thing is, if you read Jeremiah, Nebuchadnezzar did not only capture Jerusalem and Judea, he went around and he captured a lot of different nations and overthrew a lot of different nations and brought back. I mean, he just, you know, cleaned house, right, all through the whole region. And so he had captives from all kinds of nations that he was bringing back together. And they had the Jewish captives and, you know, all these other captives as well. And each one of those had their own gods. Each of the nations had their own gods that they worshipped, and they had their own wise men who were supposed to be in touch with their gods. You know, all this kind of stuff. So yeah, he was impressed with those guys, but then, you know, he was impressed probably with a lot of other people when they came before him as well. But he gave these guys the test, the ultimate test, to find out if they were just, you know, basically full of hot air, or if they really did have some kind of connection to the gods, right? And the only ones who were able to do his request, obviously, was these Jewish guys.
Besides that, Daniel probably was hanging around the king's court, like, around everything, but later on he has to be summoned again,
right?
You know, after, you know,
he considered, I mean, he understood that he was in a pagan culture and a pagan nation. He didn't try to be self-promoting and all that kind of stuff in that. You know, he probably pretty much stayed in the background until these life and death situations called for it, and then he came to prominence again and again. But anyway, all right.